Alors donc je disais merci à Maud et à Sophie pour m'avoir gentiment invitée à participer ici aujourd'hui dans ce séminaire. Et je suis ravie de vous voir et d'être ici, de présenter un tout petit peu les débuts de mon nouveau projet qui traite de plusieurs choses, mais une de ces choses, c'est les modistes, et les modistes surtout de la première moitié du 19e siècle. Donc, chronologiquement, je suis assez éloignée de ce qui va venir, mais je crois j'espère qu'il y aura des liens. Et je vais parler en anglais. Ça fait partie d'un projet de recherche en anglais, donc je présente en anglais, mais vous pouvez me poser des questions soit en anglais, soit en français, c'est comme vous voulez après. Merci. So let me begin by situating for you what I'll be presenting today. This is part of a new book, as Maud already mentioned, a book project called Behind the Seams, Women, Fashion, and Work in 19th Century France. The idea for the book came from the leftovers of my first book, which Maud also mentioned, Accessories to Modernity, which explored the connection between respectability and dress in 19th century France. The less respectable the lady, the more visible her dress seams, and anything seamy those gaps might reveal. By contrast, a well-sewn dress, custom-made to function as a second skin, denoted the seamless elegance of respectability. And I already made a disclaimer about this image. It's not the best image, but it's a sort of metaphoric illustration of what I'm trying to say. And I like to promote Vassar College's costume collection whenever possible. So there it is. The literal seaming of clothing thus expressed both social and moral distinctions. The pins and hooks, threads and stitches holding together the respectable garment were artfully concealed under yards of silk, lace, velvet, or wool, leaving the impression that effortless elegance was innate. Not only were the processes and tools of fabrication invisible, and here's the point I'll be building on in my current project, but also so was the labor spent to create fashion, since clothing worked hard to conceal its own production. And as we well know, garments and idealized femininity magically materialized on the gorgeous hand-colored pages of the fashion press. The women working, quote, behind the seams of France's early fashion economy were in a sense hidden from view. The couturière who cut and sewed, the modiste who trimmed the dress and created an embellished matching hat, the women who chronicled fashion's vagaries week in and week out, and the earliest female fashion illustrators whose pictures circled the globe, all are relatively absent from the dominant pages of history. Present in a different way, though, these fashion workers haunted popular culture, even as they made the real fashion economy function. And traces of their work remain in quiet archives, wardrobes, fashion magazines, popular literature, and vaudeville plays and prints. These are the primary sources of my book, and these last two, prints and vaudevilles, are what I'll be considering here today, in particular in their representation of the modiste and her essential tool, the marotte, or head form. And there are lots of words for the marotte, but I'm using marotte today, tête à poupée, maybe you've heard of. I'll be exploring these two figures in the first half of the 19th century and how their representation in the atelier and beyond shifts between popular prints and the vaudeville stage. My intention here is to illuminate how such figures embodied all kinds of tensions around class, gender, and the general social order at a particularly interesting moment in fashion history. So first, a brief overview of the modiste. And my audience is not typically a group of fashion historians, and so I apologize in advance if this is all very familiar to you. Of the many fashion workers on display in the print culture of the first half of the 19th century, the modiste stands out as a cultural riddle. The so-called elite member of the vast array of female fashion workers, the modiste was much celebrated in image, song, and on the vaudeville stage. In spite of this apparent surplus of visibility, or perhaps because of it, this figure nonetheless remains the most mysterious, most ambiguous, and potentially least understood of 19th century female fashion workers. While her activities ranged from dress accessorizing and embellishment to styling, and of course hat making, the modiste's work is difficult to define as it transformed and narrowed over the course of the century. She was thus a liminal figure who served as an index for concerns about working women in public. unlike the couturière who constructed the foundation and sewed the seams of dresses, the modiste was charged with concealing those very seams, along with any other visible evidence of the fabrication of garments and headgear, beneath layers of luxurious artifices. The modiste, or her earlier avatar, the marchande de mode, was thus deemed an artist, while the seamstress remained a worker. As both artisan of fantasy luxury creations and delicious object of consumption herself, the Parisian modiste occupied a peculiar space in relation to luxe, luxure, in the popular imaginary. Demure and elegant in this 1824 depiction, the modiste's profession is signaled by her outsized circular hat box. Bedecked in lace, dainty slippers, silk, gloves, and shawl, she exudes the luxury of the object she conceals in her carton. The components of hat embellishment were indeed luxurious, and the seamless perfection of the creation suggested the magic wrought by the artful hand and keen eye of the skilled modiste. The luxury objects she created, however, owed much of their appeal to the erasure of the labor required to produce them, labor that was poorly remunerated, leading often to indigence and to its logical corollary, prostitution. The modiste's popular profile as a trotteuse, moving around Paris with her hat box, reinforced the cliché that along with the hats on display, also for sale, was the modiste. She was cast as both consumer and a model because she was portrayed as desiring the luxury objects she produced and because to inspire the confidence of her clientele, the modiste needed to project the art of fashionable display on her person. Participating in the luxury market from both ends, then, this figure crystallized anxieties surrounding the precariousness of working-class women. As this Gavarni print, with its foreboding depiction of the still elegant modiste, intimates, modistes were often portrayed at work, either creating goods in their atelier or delivering them, as they strode through the streets of Paris, hiding the product either literally within trademark hat boxes or figuratively through the shift in focus from product to producer, as happens in images such as this, deflects emphasis away from labor and product, and indeed makes the modiste's activity look nothing at all like labor. Emphasis is placed instead on the provocative look of the pretty fashion worker herself, l'agaçante modiste, with her exposed bosom irreverently ornamented with an outsized cross, delicate fingers and coquettish pose. Through the reproduction and dissemination of many such images, the myth of the immodest modiste took shape in the cultural imaginary. It was a myth with longevity and had the power to occlude her actual labor. This myth was twofold. It posited her role as both eroticized commodity and social climber, and it was in the atelier that the myth developed. The atelier was often presented as a place of great disorder, thus inviting the viewer into the spectacle of desire while simultaneously invoking a need for greater social control. Printed during the First Empire between 1802 and 1814 and published by Pierre de la Mésangère, this satirical print from Le Bon Genre depicting an atelier de modiste offers important clues to the popular perception of these fashion workers. Fashionably, if scantily dressed, even by empire standards, each of the four modistes models a different look and engages in various activities. The décolletage of the standing woman's pink gown is noteworthy, especially as she carries a hat box and wears a capote, two details that signal she is about to go outside of the atelier into the street, likely on a delivery. She seems to assist the seated woman on the left who adjusts a headpiece on her brow, as if trying on one of her own creations, thereby blurring the line between producer and consumer of luxury goods. To the right, we see another worker, wearing a fashionable turban and attaching feathers to another turban she's creating on the head form, or marotte, she holds suggestively between her knees. The last of the workers, perhaps the maîtresse modiste, is elegantly dressed in blue with matching coif. She holds a book she seems to be reading, possibly a romance novel, even as she engages in the sociability of the atelier. En pied, or hat stands, also sometimes called champignons, completed straw and fabric hats are displayed, while at the feet of one worker, wide-brim hat forms await decoration.
Strewn across the table are the tools and elements of embellishment: ribbons, pins, braids, flowers, scissors, tape measure, and pin cushion. Everything here is in disarray, from the scattered work materials to the workers themselves, seemingly unsupervised. Images such as this, in which the space of the atelier signals both work and commerce, and in which an erotic subtext between the women themselves and between the women and spectators is often figured, proliferated in the first part of the 19th century. The visual grammar of this and other images insists on eroticizing not only the work and the feminized spectacle of fashion, but also, obviously, the modiste, a process that turns them into potential objects of erotic consumption, even as it reinforces the troubling liminality associated with the figure who is ill-defined and thus easily mythologized. How does the marotte further this troubling liminality? Silent partners in fashion's most elite industry, and I'm borrowing that term from Jane Monroe, marottes were also visual and material reminders of fashion's objectification of women as consumers and fashion's erasure of women as producers. The silence of their partnership opens up onto endless narrative possibilities, and like the fashion doll, the fashion plate model, the mannequin, the marotte belongs to a family of feminine impersonators, one might say. Their evident practical function in the processes of fabrication and display served fashion's inseparable objectives of production and marketing. But marottes were also powerful symbolic visual props in the construction of an idealized femininity. Depictions of modistes at work in the atelier frequently feature marottes, perhaps to emphasize the reality effect of the representation. It was, after all, an essential tool of the trade. The picturing of the workroom permits us to see the marotte, which in turn gives rise to the slippage between the modiste and the marotte in these images, creating an uneasy association between woman and inanimate object, and also between producer and consumer for whom the marotte stands in. In these next images, we find again modiste at work in the atelier, but here the head form plays a more prominent role. In both of these images from the 1830s and 40s, the modistes are pictured with model heads that allow them to produce a deluxe chapeau. In both cases, the marotte is made up and lifelike. In fact, the artist has taken pains to assimilate modiste and marotte. The inanimate head uncannily resembles the live fashion worker depicted, because of course she's also represented, depicted next to it. Both têtes are oriented in the same direction as the modiste's own heads, further emphasizing the doubling of the living modiste and the inanimate head. And while both modistes are clearly engaged in work, neither looks at the object she is creating. Instead, each gazes out at the spectator, or, in a pose typical of fashion plates, in an indeterminate direction, showing her delicate profile and ringlet curls to best advantage. Both of these modistes are engaged in luxury production, and although wearing the traditional black apron that commonly designated a fashion worker, both are also quite stylish, a visual straddling of class identity that contributes to one of the principal elements of the myth of the modiste, that she's dangerously similar to the bourgeois consumer herself, thus capable of passing and potentially disrupting the social order. This mirroring between modiste and marotte, an assimilation of producer and consumable product, insists on the commodification of the former, yet it also proposes that the modiste controls the shaping of her own image, inasmuch as she's pictured literally shaping her own double. Thus we see that a marotte, like a mannequin, is an idealizing mirror, an inanimate double, often resembling the modiste herself, who was frequently portrayed as harboring aspirations of becoming a bourgeois consumer. We find the same kind of duplication in an image created by the celebrated caricaturist and fashion illustrator Numa, who here portrays the morning rise of the modiste, set in the dortoir, with its predictably erotic overtones and shabby, chic, intimate interior. The details of this image are familiar to a 19th century audience. Peeling wallpaper and cracks in the walls, a cashmere shawl serving as a blanket, hat box functioning as a night table, and hat decorations strewn about the floor. In addition, one semi-clad modiste watches from bed as the other dresses her hair in the mirror. her reflection just visible over the wide brim of an elaborately decorated hat worn by a marotte on the dressing table. Though it's possible that this fanciful creation belongs to one of the modistes, it's more likely the property of the maîtresse modiste, the boss, since the fashion worker was expected to work from home, trimming a client's hat in the evening and returning it to the atelier when finished. But the indeterminate ownership of the hat works again to destabilize the figure of the modiste. She's both a producer and an aspiring consumer of fashion. Moreover, the composition of the illustration and the curious placement of the marotte call attention to the blurring of animate and inanimate, so often latent in fashion illustration and truly key to fashion's success. The head clones the reflection in the mirror, already a double, and the marotte's sightless gaze serves as a pendant to that of the living, reclining girl on the bed. So there are really five heads in the image, if you consider the image on the wall, which also has a hat, and a network of eyes and gazes, including the spectators, all of which are working both to posit and to expose the seamlessness of femininity. At the same time, the head form and the multiplication process in which it participates once again evoke the slippage between woman and object upon which fashion discourse and illustration rely for their powers of suggestion in their marketing of desire. Now, if the marotte in popular print culture served to illustrate the blurring of modiste with both commodity and consumer and offered, if unwittingly, a critique of the objectification of women in fashion, this object was freighted with a different cultural critique when it passed to the stage. More so even than popular print culture, vaudeville theater highlighted the contradictions inherent in the figure of the modiste. And the role of the marotte as her double would move to the stage and shift as the modiste was endowed with greater subjectivity. This deeper complexity and shifting critical perspective can be explained in part by the nature of vaudeville itself, which catered to popular and bourgeois classes and was closely entwined with mass culture and social commentary. Vaudeville audiences were mixed, both in terms of class and gender. And we know from at least one autobiographical account of a modiste from the mid-19th century that heading to the vaudeville theater was a typical pastime for these fashion workers. While it's undeniable that vaudeville did the work of myth-making in a way similar to that of the reproduction and circulation of suggestive prints like the ones we've been looking at, it did something else as well. It staged modistes who seem intent, whether self-consciously or not, on rehabilitating their image, or making it in the world of honest commerce. In play after play, plots revolve around a modiste's attempt to redress the myth that unfairly characterizes her. In an 1821 vaudeville entitled La Nina de la Rue Vivienne, the plot unfolds around the madness of a modiste who, having been forced into the trade by her greedy father, must flirt with all the customers in hopes of finding a wealthy husband. De sa beauté voyant l'éclat, il la fit entrer chez une modiste pour lui donner un bon état. Becoming a modiste was thus coded as both social climbing and prostitution. However, Nina is in love with Arlequin, who at one point poses as an Englishman to test her love. When her suitor inexplicably disappears, she goes mad, and in his absence, she paints her marotte to resemble him. Her madness is also signaled by the disorder of her dress. Here's a print from the printed version of the play, as the stage directions instruct. Elle a une robe blanche, un tablier vert mis de côté. Sa coiffure est en désordre. As opposed to the sexual disorder of some of the immodest modistes we saw before, Nina's disorder stems from the barbaric parental prescription that as a modiste, she must please all the men who come through the shop. Furthermore, in love with both the Englishman and her French beau, who are, the audience knows, the same person, her folie seems to have been precipitated as much by their sudden disappearance as by her confusion as to which one of them she actually loves, and the taint on her integrity indicated by her capacity to love two suitors at once. The audience understands, however, that she loves only one, and thus that her honor is intact. When Arlequin returns, having made his fortune in India, he hides in plain sight, standing in for the tête en carton, which is another term for the marotte, while Nina tries out all kinds of bonnets on his head, readying her pins to stab the ribbons in place. Her épingle, I should note, we were just speaking beforehand about la distinction entre les épingles, les aiguilles qui figurent sur la belle affiche. Mais les épingles, ça a une connotation un peu différente que, ouais. It's linked, in fact, to female virtue, as opposed to l'aiguille, which is linked to the opposite. In her madness, she has not only feminized him, but she has also turned him into a kind of voodoo doll on whom to project her repressed fury at her plight. He cries out before she sticks him, and the rest of the play stages the gradual reestablishment of her suitor's original identity and Nina's return to sanity. Unbeknownst to the mad Nina with her épingle, she has forced him to reconcile his double identity, a plot conceived in order to catch her in her moral duplicity, but which ends up revealing her suitor's error, her father's mercenary treatment, and her own integrity. The hatpin gag is a favorite with vaudeville modiste. It allows for easy physical comedy, but it also literalizes the notion of retribution, punishing male characters for their collusion with the modiste's mythically shaped status as a femme légère. In a vaudeville from 1834, aptly entitled La Révolte des Modistes, a group of young fashion workers rebel against their mistress's overbearing rules when she refuses to allow them to go to a ball with their beau. One of the young men, Géricault, remains in the atelier after inviting the girls, having not fled in time before the arrival of the mistress, Madame Clément. While claiming to search for her pin box, she's actually keeping tabs on the girls. She is the regulatory presence that signals the ce qui va de soi of any myth. But the play stages the girls as honest and their suitors as potential scoundrels. Géricault's sweetheart Finette hides him under the counter and proceeds to fabricate a hat on his head using the traditional pose of the modiste so as not to compromise her reputation. Ironically, with a man's head between her legs, as in the earlier print I showed you before. So this is not an illustration from the play, but it recreates a similar scene. Again, the stage directions offer the key gestures both of slapstick humor and identity play. Finette, viens ici et ne bouge pas. Elle met Géricault entre ses jambes. Une chaise chargée d'étoffe lui masque le dos. Elle lui place aussitôt un chapeau sur la tête. Elle est censée tenir une poupée en carton. He hides there, posing as her marotte, as the maîtresse modiste comes into the workroom to see what the workers are up to. Unhappy with Finette's work, she rearranges the ribbons and pokes a pin straight into Géricault's head, thus punishing him unwittingly for his illicit presence in the atelier. The cultural anxieties surrounding the modiste's upward mobility, we saw represented in the prints through the doubling of the marotte and the fashion worker, are transformed on the vaudeville stage as the marotte is figured as the modiste's antagonist in her struggle for self-determination within a patriarchal system. Here, as before, the modiste's mythic reputation is turned on its head, for Finette becomes an activist worker, demanding higher pay and fairer working conditions, even leading her small group in a strike. As expected in a genre whose formula demands a happy ending, even if social structures don't necessarily remain intact, the plot devolves into a gender battle when the mistress, who is the stand-in for surveillance, enlists the suitors to bring the girls back to work on the condition that she allow them to take the modiste to the ball. All returns to normal in the end, of course. The modistes happily paired with their respective beaux and returning to the workroom. But their rebellion did earn them a night out, and Finette emerges as an early spokeswoman, albeit in comic form, of workers' rights. Her reputation as a loose woman is just a theatrical pretext, then, to open up possibilities of slapstick humor and identity play. And by the drama's end, her dominant identity as a fair-minded worker all but erases the mythic reputation of the flirty modiste. From the 1820s to the 1860s, vaudeville's stage modiste, who had to overcome the weight of a precarious reputation, over and over in these plays, and there are actually many of them, the modiste's presumed lack of virtue is a given that could be used to conceal other characters' misbehavior. To conclude, I'll turn to a one-act monologue vaudeville from 1855 entitled Les Débuts de la Modiste. This play exploits the unsettling potential of marotte to engage with questions of doubling we saw in the prints, but it also once again showcases the agency of the otherwise invisible, silent fashion worker. In this short play, Alexandrine, a young modiste employed in her aunt's atelier, is working alone one Sunday while all the other shop girls are out for a party in the countryside. Unjustly put to work while the others have some leisure time, she illustrates the sense of frustration that young girls with limited options must have experienced in their daily grind. Alexandrine protests, "Je suis condamnée à une journée de magasin et 12 heures de surveillance. Quelle indignité!" As we'll see, the head forms reinforce both the modiste's drudgery and the de-animation that the young fashion worker discovers in the fashion industry. But they also activate a fantasy of animation that ultimately leads to the protagonist's success as an actress. With the scene constructed as an atelier de mode, the stage directions indicate à droite et à gauche des tables avec des têtes à chapeau. The young apprentice is further aggrieved in that she doesn't even want to be a modiste, but dreams rather of becoming an actress. Her uncle, by the way, is a theater director. She suffers from stage fright, though, and can only practice her chosen vocation for the silent dummies. She says, "Je ne suis jamais si hardie que lorsque je récite ici mes rôles devant les estimables têtes à chapeau que voilà. Il n'y a que ces dignes et braves femmes qui ne m'intimident pas." In the space of one sentence, she has replaced tête à chapeau with dame and has brought her audience to life. She continues, allons mesdames, faites toilette, mettez vos chapeaux neufs. Je vous invite toutes à venir assister au début de Mademoiselle Alexandrine. Y êtes-vous? C'est ça. Formez la galerie et ne bavardez pas surtout. Fully recognizing why these têtes don't intimidate her, she nonetheless proceeds to anthropomorphize them. They become braves femmes, mesdames, vous, aimables spectatrices. She coiffs the anonymous and identical têtes in order to give each of them a distinct identity, and she talks to them as if they're reacting to the show, even modifying her performance to please one in particular. A tête in the rear, wearing a green hat, is making a face because of the risque nature of Alexandrine's dance. Her fantasy animation of the Marotte works to demystify the idea of a theater public. And in fact, Alexandrine gives such a fine performance that her spying uncle hires her, and her dream of acting comes true. In classic vaudeville fashion, visibly blurring the lines between stage and public, and thus shattering the so-called fourth wall, Alexandrine turns to the audience to sing her last air, having overcome her stage fright, and demands the requisite round of applause. It should be noted, of course, that the vaudeville actress is herself another type of worker who week after week had to memorize several plays. So this creates another kind of kinship of workers. The uncanny presence of Marotte is significant in these representations of modistes in 19th century popular culture, and they need to be deciphered in relation to other forms used in the world of fashion to mimic women. Vaudeville's modistes are, for the most part, well aware of their mythical status, but these plays also cultivate our awareness of the other side of the working girl, her industriousness, her solidarity with other working girls, her drive to succeed, and her skill in creating fashion, which sometimes becomes her survival mechanism or even her escape hatch. I'm not going so far as to suggest that vaudeville is somehow the subversive antidote to the mythologizing print culture of the period. Rather, vaudeville has it both ways. The myth is preserved, thus satisfying the prurient interest of the bourgeois public in the sexualization of the working woman, and satisfying that same public's desire for moral delineation from the working classes. But the myth is also challenged by the modiste who defies her narrative and sticks it to bourgeois institutions and very often masculine control. The discourse, both visual and theatrical, surrounding the modiste and the marotte, worked to manage social anxieties, just as it also exposed key truths about fashion's power, even in its early days. Making working women the object of public and popular discourse offered interpretive opportunities that kept social roles in check. And precisely because it was a public discourse, it was subject to multiple interpretations and could thus be manipulated in a variety of ways and for a variety of purposes. These prints and plays become the site for competing social aspirations around class and gender. Recognition of fashion's spectacular objectification of women abounds in these representations of modistes, but resistance to that impulse also creeps in, especially in vaudeville theater, where the working woman began to emerge as a subject. This spectral fashion worker, at once invisible and ubiquitous, and her eerie doll-like other, thus projected from the early 19th century page and stage the impossible paradox of women's relation to fashion. Merci.
Ou si, sinon, les suggestions. Je suis au début d'un projet de recherche, donc j'aimerais bien savoir si vous avez des choses à me dire.
Est-ce que...
Des pistes à explorer.
Des questions. Ben moi, j'ai une question, du coup.
D'accord.
Ben justement, ces marottes,
oui.
Qui les fabrique, qui les fait? Ils ont tous des visages.
Oui.
C'est intéressant, parce que vers la fin du siècle, tout d'un coup, il n'y a plus le visage, ils ne sont plus anthropomorphized. Oui. Yeah. C'est oui. Lisse. Donc, je me oui. demande vraiment le...
Oui, c'est un des domaines où il faut plus de recherche. Moi, il faut que moi, je fasse plus de recherche. Mais je sais qu'il y avait des... c'était une industrie d'hommes, si masculine, si je ne me trompe pas, la fabrication de ces têtes. Têtes en carton, parfois c'était en bois. Donc, il y avait toute une industrie, mais, et aussi pour le mannequin. Le mannequin, je crois que c'était à peu près le même type d'industrie.
Oui.
Mais ce n'est pas une réponse bien remplie. Mais
c'est intéressant.
Il y a un livre, et j'ai emprunté ce terme, Silent Partners. Il y a eu une exposition ici à Paris au printemps passé,
oui,
qui s'appelait Baudet. Silent Partners. C'était autour du mannequin.
Oui.
Et là, dans le catalogue, je crois qu'il y aurait des renseignements là-dessus. Mm. Ouais. C'était une exposition vraiment passionnante.
Oui, ouais. Je ne l'ai pas vue,
oui. Mais
je voulais le voir.
Sorry, I missed the beginning of your talk. Just about okay. These marottes, were they ever made of wax, do you know? Or?
Oh, I don't know, but that's a great question. I know... There's certainly a link between the marotte and the wax, you know, wax figures and wax museum figures. Again, I would refer you to the catalog that Jane Monroe produced for the Silent Partners, because I know she talks about wax figures in there as well. I don't know if they're made of wax. The ones that I've read about, and what is interesting is they very often appear in inventories of stage props. Mm-hmm. So this is another clue about the ubiquity of the modiste in the vaudeville stage. The marotte was a very frequent prop on the stage. But I think they're very often called tête en carton. And tête en carton, and I know, I own one actually, and it's made of bois. It's wood and painted. And I think they also, from what I do understand, they were made in a variety of sizes. So a client would have her marotte, would have her tête à poupée at her favorite modiste. But I don't really know very much about the history of the object. That's one of my areas of exploration. Right now, I'm more interested in pursuing in my comfort zone, which is the representation and the symbolic resonance of these objects. But I very much want to learn more about the history. Yeah. Oui, merci, parce que j'entends pas.
Bonjour. Est-ce que l'usage de ces marottes est spécifiquement français?
Je regarde Suzy parce que ça, je ne sais pas. J'imagine que... J'invente parce que je n'ai pas du tout fait de recherche en Angleterre ni aux États-Unis. Donc, j'hésite. Je dirais que non, que ce n'est pas spécifiquement français. Peut-être que l'usage que moi, j'observe est spécifiquement français, parce que ce qui m'intéresse, c'est l'entrée dans la culture française de cet objet. Et ça a une résonance particulièrement française. Mais l'usage de l'objet, je crois que bon, les modistes britanniques devaient utiliser un objet pareil, n'est-ce pas ? C'est un outil. Mais est-ce que ça entrait dans la culture populaire, dans l'imaginaire, de la même façon ? Ça, je ne peux pas vous le dire et je ne sais pas. Je regarde Suzy parce qu'elle est anglaise, mais...
The image of the British seamstress was quite different, especially in the Victorian era, and it's something that I've researched a little bit. So this French image of the seductive seamstress, going right back to, as you mentioned, the marchand des modes mm-hmm. of the 18th century, it doesn't really exist in English popular culture, where the seamstress is more usually portrayed as a poor, downtrodden girl without the charms that the French modiste or couturière or grisette is imbued with in France.
And that's very interesting to me, because there's something at work here, you see, in this particular mythologizing of the French modiste. And the modiste was different from the couturière. I mean, I know that you're going to talk about a different type of couturière, but I'm talking about the couturière, the seamstress, really, not the creator. Yeah.
Not only the seamstresses, but the grisettes and
yes. Yes, I do. Yes, yeah. Her new project is on the grisette. But within the grisette would have been sort of a catch-all term, and then you have couturière. But the modistes were at the highest rung of that working girl hierarchy, and this is, I come back to the aiguille and the épingle, because the aiguille was the symbol of the couturière, and in French folklore it has the resonance of this is where you get the idea of the femme légère. And if I may be so brazen as to say, the aiguille has a hole, and there were all kinds of interpretive possibilities that were amply developed. The épingle, par contre, had no hole. So the modiste was considered the virtuous. And yet, in these representations, elle glisse vers la légèreté. And I think it really all has to do with controlling social mobility. And the fact that the modiste had access to luxury and could pass as someone beyond her class. And this, of course, I'm a student of Balzac, and so everything for me is inflected through the filter of Balzac. The anxiety produced by sudden social mobility in the first half of the 19th century is hard for us to comprehend. And I think this is one of the places where it's being worked out.
But at some point during... around maybe the middle of the second half of the 19th century, the modiste became purely a
hat,
a milliner, a maker of hats, mm-hmm. because then in the couture houses they would trim the dresses them in-house. Mm-hmm. She metamorphosed.
Yes, no, absolutely. I mean, even in these early images, hats were the main thing, but then trimming dresses, sort of styling people. But yes, you're right. And there's been a lot of work done on the modiste in the second half of the 19th century, especially the last two decades. A lot of art historians have done some very fine work on the modiste and picking up on this sort of mythology of her. But there's sort of been less exploration of how the myth developed. Why did it develop? And it's very interesting to me to see that there's sort of a competing narrative between the printed popular image and the staged popular image. So I'm still working it out.
I think also perhaps because the couture industry and the fashion industry and the, les industries de luxe were so large and such an important part of the French economy, there were far more women visibly working in those industries. There were far more women and they were far more visible on the streets than the English seamstress would have been.
Right, right. Well, and Paris couture in the 19th century, that was really where everything originated. So, yeah. Ah, oui, il n'y a pas de chapeau, malheureusement. Non. Oui, c'est une collection. On est en train de rehabilitate. Je cherche le mot. De restaurer, voilà, de restaurer. On est toujours en train de restaurer. Il n'y a pas beaucoup de fonds pour cela, mais ça. Nous avons des étudiants. Il y a deux personnes qui s'occupent de la collection et qui font de leur mieux pour attirer les étudiants et les instruire dans la restauration. Mais ce n'est pas formel. On a eu, je crois, il y a quelques années, on a fait une exposition, mais c'était une petite exposition. Et chaque année, on fait un défilé de mode dans le musée. On a un musée assez important à Vassar, un musée d'art. Mais chaque année, on a le droit de montrer deux ou trois robes d'une certaine époque qui reflètent le thème du défilé. Et ça, je ne pourrais pas vous dire. Je pense qu'on a pas mal, mais il y en a qui sont dans un état désastreux. Je sais qu'on en a depuis le mi-19e siècle jusqu'en, je ne sais pas, les années... Bon, on continue à donner. Ouais. Ouais. Je crois qu'il y a des merveilles dans cette collection que je n'ai pas vues. Pas. Merci. Alors je ferme la...